convulses. My muscles tighten so suddenly and completely that wrists and ankles and hips smash against the bars holding them down. I burn. I'm burning up. I'm going to die. I don't want to die. She lifts the rod and the pain stops. My breath comes rushing back. I taste blood.
Silly girl, Matilda says.
You bit through your lip.
I suppose that serves you right, but don't damage yourself any further.
The withered hand reaches for my face. I don't want that pain again, so I close my eyes and stay still. Rough, dry fingers on my forehead, sliding across my skin.
Look what you've done to my pretty hair, she says.
I can't wait to feel a brush slide through it once again. It's been so long. This dead thing is petting me. I'm terrified and disgusted. I'm hateful and alone. She makes a tisk-tisk sound. I feel her pull something out of my hair. I force myself to open my eyes and look at my killer. If I am to die, I will die facing my enemy. She's holding a bit of twig. As soon as the transfer is done, I'm going to take a long bath, she says. I'm going to clean up this filth you've caked on yourself. This is no way for an empress to look.
Brewer said he was on our side, I said. Why did he lie about the shuttle being the only way down here?
He didn't lie. There used to be 5 shuttles. During the rebellion, Brewer's people destroyed all but one. Then he locked us out of the hangar. When you made me take you to the hangar, I didn't think it would be open, but Brewer unlocked it for you.
That was the first time I'd laid eyes on a shuttle in 2 centuries.
Then what about Bello's ship?
We built it, Matilda says.
We thought we might need a way down to Omeokan someday, and 200 years is a lot of time to make contingency plans. Brewer ruined the shuttle fleet, but there is so much of this Olodal he doesn't control, where he can't see what's happening. The ship we made isn't as elegant as the one you stole, but it was good enough to get 13 of us safely down to the surface. While you dealt with Bello, the rest of us came here and prepared.
I look her up and down, take in her old, ruined body. How could she have reached the top of the observatory in order to get down here?
She keeps petting me. I have to clench my teeth together to resist biting her again.
I'm sure you're wondering about all those steps, she says.
Sometimes it's hard to remember how unimaginative I was at your age.
There are other entrances to this place, pretty girl. Do you think I wanted to spend my next life trudging up and down 3,000 steps? If you and your bishop had walked around the temple and looked carefully, you would have found a normal entrance that leads right to this very spot. No symbol required, no steps involved.
She called it a temple, just like Aramovsky did. My head hurts so bad. It feels like my brain has been crushed and smashed, and this sense of failure is making it worse.
Coyotl and Beckett were overwritten, I say. Is Mueller still alive?
You sending those 3 out was a wonderful break for us, and with a functioning pentapod, no less. Little Victor Mueller is locked up in an observatory prison cell, where he'll stay until we retake the shuttle. We will take the shuttle up to the Zolotl instead of the awful ship we came down in. Aramovsky said you didn't take any joyrides, fortunately, so there should be enough fuel for the return trip.
The taller of the 2 grown-ups on the pedestal platform calls out,
We are ready.
That's the woman. Her voice, so old yet so familiar. Please don't let it be her. Please don't let it be her.
Is that Spingate? Matilda laughs.
Spingate was on Brewer's side. I had Bishop cave in her skull with one of those silly tools she liked so much.
Don't worry, pretty girl. Aramovsky will make sure your Spingate is armed and in the first wave he sends against the vermin.
No! You can't make her fight! She's pregnant!
Amazing, Matilda says. You hormone-engorged little brats didn't waste any time, did you? Running around like animals.
How about you, Em? She spits my name like it's a curse word. Were you a sinful slut like Teresa? Did you steal my virginity from me?
I didn't do anything. I don't know about anyone else. Just Spingate and Gaston.
What?
The word is a shout, commanding, insistent,
that comes from the pedestal platform. The little grown-up steps onto the floor and walks toward us. He stops next to Matilda. "Captain," she says. I'm surprised to hear respect in her voice. Does this tiny man intimidate her? He stares down at me through his mask, two red eyes thrumming with excitement and intensity. The Spingate shell is pregnant with my child. I don't know what to say. Will they want to kill her and the baby, or will the truth keep her off the battlefield? This creature is 1,000 years old, but there has to be some bit of the Gaston I know still in there. I nod. He turns to Matilda. I will tell Eremovsky to bring her to me. Without waiting for an answer, he walks off into the shadows. One-eyed Matilda seems rattled. She gestures to the platform, to the lone grown-up standing there. Obviously, that is not Teresa's Spingate, Matilda says. But I'm sure you know this one, Shell. May I present the lovely and talented Dr. Kenzie Smith? The grown-up on the platform bows stiffly. She starts to stand, then freezes, a gnarled hand going to her back.
Oh, she says. Damn it. That hurts.
She slowly straightens, holds on to a pedestal for balance.
Let's get this started. I need to sit down soon.
Matilda rubs her nasty hands together. The skin is so rough I can hear it.
Finally, we're ready, she says. Not you, Matilda, Smith says. I'm afraid Bishop hit your shell on the head a little too hard. There could be a concussion. We have to wait so that I can make sure there isn't any damage I need to fix first.
Matilda's one eye swirls madly. She's furious. She glares at someone in the corner. I crane my head up to see the hulking form of old Bishop. He's been standing there the entire time, silent, unmoving.
You stupid oaf, she says to him. I told you to be careful.
I hear concern in her hiss of a voice, perhaps even fear. Brewer said the longer we were alive, forming our own memories and connections, the less chance the process had of working. But it worked on Bello, Coyotl, and Beckett, so it will likely work on me, unless my grinding headache causes problems somehow.
I've waited so long, Matilda says. A few hours more won't matter.
She gives my hair a final pat.
Since you've been so difficult, my dear, let's watch something together while we wait.
Kenzie, open it. The golden coffin to my left makes the same sound mine made. The sides lower. My heart shatters. I want to wake up. I want all of this to be a horrible dream. It's O'Malley. He's lying on white linen, held down by the same kind of bars that hold me. He's blinking, just coming awake.
O'Malley, it's Em. Look at me.
He turns his head, terror wrinkling his face. He sees me, recognizes me, then starts looking everywhere, up, left, right, down toward his feet. He cranes his head back, trying to see behind him.
Em, are we in the observatory?
On the platform, one of the pedestals starts to glow.
Pre-imprinting preparations complete, Smith says. We're ready. Bring in Kevin.
I'm confused for a moment. Kevin O'Malley is right next to me. Then with a chest-ripping blast of horror, I understand. And so does he.
No, he says. Don't do this!
Past our feet, I see Coyotl helping a masked grown-up walk toward the black X. A grown-up so old and withered, he can barely move.
Is it time? The old one says. Is it finally my time?
The voice sounds ancient, like it's made of dust and worm-eaten wood. And yet I recognize it, instantly. It is the voice of Kevin O'Malley. In the coffin next to me, my friend starts to scream.
40.
Behind the clear mask, old O'Malley's red eyes appear cloudy, unfocused. Matilda pets my hair.
Just watch, little one, she says. Your turn is coming soon.
I shake my head over and over.
Please, don't kill him.
O'Malley pulls at his restraints. His eyes blaze with animal panic. He grunts desperately, throws himself left and right. Matilda is standing between my coffin and his. She turns, raises the red cane, snaps it down on his stomach.
His back arches so suddenly and severely, I wonder if a spine might snap. His throat grinds out a g-g-g-g-g sound that makes me scream in helpless rage. She lifts the rod.
"You will not hurt your body. Not now," she says to him. "Struggle again, you get the rod again."
Coyote mostly drags old O'Malley to the black axe. Old Bishop comes over to help. Together, they raise the shriveled grown-up's arms, lock the shackles around his wrists, then restrain his ankles. Bishop removes old O'Malley's mask. Those disgusting folds of wet flesh, they either cover the grown-up's mouth, or they are the mouth. Sickening to look at. Coyote slides the black crown onto the withered creature's head. Roomy red eyes stare out with a combination of confusion and excitement. The old monster starts to cough.
"Hard to breathe. I need my mask."
Coyote gives him a hard pat on the cheek.
"Don't worry, Kev. In a few minutes, the mask won't matter."
The old one's red eyes seem to go clear for a moment. He stares at my O'Malley.
"By the gods," the old thing says. It's me."
The young and the ancient lock eyes. A low growl starts in my O'Malley's throat, builds to a scream as he starts to thrash against his restraints. Matilda lowers the rod. My O'Malley again goes rigid. He shudders and bucks, tries to beg her to stop, but his mouth won't form words.
"You horrible bitch," I roar. "Stop it or I'll kill you."
Matilda turns to me, smacks the rod down on my thigh. The charge sets my body ablaze. I try not to scream. I fail. She lifts the rod.
"No cursing," she says. "Children should know the rules."
Old O'Malley is half giggling, half coughing.
"My shell is so strong," he says. "So much vigor."
Everything grows blurry as tears fill my eyes.
"Please, Matilda."
"I'll beg. I'll plead. I'll sacrifice myself, whatever it takes."
"Let him go, and I swear I'll let you do it to me."
My O'Malley's head turns fast to face me, his features contorted with both fear and anger.
"Em, no, don't promise them anything."
Even now, with blood on his lips from where he bit through them, his cheeks streaked with tears, he is beautiful. How could I not have told this boy that I loved him? I am desperate for him to live, even if that means my own death. I tear my eyes away from him, force myself to look at her.
"Matilda, please."
My voice is weak, subservient.
"I swear, I'll do whatever you want. I won't fight."
She pats my head, makes that tisk-tisk sound with her unseen mouth.
"Oh, my dear, you can fight all you like. It won't make any difference."
"Preparations complete," old Smith calls out.
"Ometeodol?"
"Ready for instructions, doctor," the room answers.
"Perform transference power-up and pre-flight checks."
The entire room hums, a long droning sound that makes my hair stand on end. Coyote walks over to my O'Malley. The overwritten circle star leans close, the expression of gleeful hate, something I would have never thought could exist on his face.
"This is going to hurt," Coyote says. His words ring with a sick joy. "So much."
My O'Malley can't fight anymore. He has nothing left. All he can do is cry.
"Em, please," he says in a whisper. "Help me."
Sobs rack my body. I can't do anything. I am powerless. Leader, empress, monster, friend, enemy. When it matters most, I am none of those things. I am nothing. I am just a circle. I am empty. Old O'Malley coughs, harder than before, struggles to draw breath.
"I hope my old self hasn't changed too much," he says. "I was never a crybaby like that."
Matilda laughs. It sounds like my laugh. "Kevin,
You've been a lying, manipulating, backstabbing crybaby for 1,000 years, she says. Some things don't change.
The room darkens. Old Smith raises her arms, and they are bathed in color. The same lights that made Spingate glow like an angel soak into Old Smith's cratered skin, make her look like a moving statue that has disintegrated and blackened with age.
Ometeotl, commence final bioscan of receptacle.
Scanning, Dr. Smith.
The humming increases, almost drowns out my O'Malley's sobs and old O'Malley's cough. What little rage that still burns inside me is extinguished by a wave of hopelessness. My friend is going to die. He's an arm's length away. If only I could reach out to him. Right here, right now, Kevin O'Malley will cease to exist, and I can't stop it.
Bioscan complete, Dr. Smith,
the room says.
Zero risk factors. Ready to commence upon your order.
Old Smith lowers her glowing hands.
Commence transference.
The humming grows louder, fills the room, bounces off the ceiling and walls. My O'Malley thrashes, but not of his own will. His body is reacting, twitching and trembling, quivering and lurching. They're killing him. The hum goes on forever. It fills my head, rattles my ears and teeth. It blocks out everything. I want my hands loose, not so I can escape, but so I can drive my fingers into my ears, try to block that sound of death. And then, the volume lowers, lowers, lowers. The humming stops. I look at my friend. He's on his back, staring straight up at the ceiling. His chest heaves. He blinks rapidly, shakes his head. He wiggles his nose, curls his lips, clicks his teeth, as if he's trying out his face for the first time. Please, please, please let it have failed. O'Malley's head turns toward me. He smiles, but it isn't his smile.
Hello, young lady.
In that instant, I know my friend is no more. I'm numb. I feel nothing. I am as cold as a corpse. The monsters have won, and I'm next. Matilda walks to his coffin. She presses a small green jewel set just behind his head. O'Malley's restraints clack open. He sits up, stretches out his arms, rubs his legs, looks at his fingers like they are made of magic and wind. His eyes shine with wonder and awe.
I can't believe it, he says. I feel no pain. I knew my old body hurt, but until this very moment, I hadn't realized I spent every minute of every day in pain, and now, nothing. It's gone.
He swings his legs over the side, lets his feet dangle. The tears in my eyes make him shimmer and wave. Matilda puts a hand on his shoulder.
Slowly, at first, she says. Your body is fine, but your mind must get used to moving it again.
O'Malley brushes the hand aside, all but pushes Matilda out of the way. He slides off his coffin table and stands.
Praise be, this new person says. Praise be to all the gods. It worked.
A desperate, haunting moan of anguish makes my hair stand on end. At the X, the gnarled, restrained, grown-up O'Malley lifts his head. His frail lungs try to draw an air that is killing him. He looks around the room, disoriented.
It didn't work, he says. We must try again. I'm still trapped in this hideous body. Oh, I hurt so bad, even worse than before.
I don't understand. It did work. I can see the young O'Malley, and I know he is not mine. Young O'Malley starts to laugh. Old O'Malley's head snaps up. For the first time, the red eyes clear all the way, blink rapidly.
No, he says. This can't be.
Young O'Malley walks closer to his old self, does a little stumbling dance.
Come on now, Chancellor. You knew this would happen.
The wrinkled monster looks around the room madly. I realize that he is looking for someone to help him.
Wait, he says.
I didn't think it would be like this.
Young O'Malley reaches toward Bishop, palm up. The hulking monster hands over a sheathed knife. O'Malley takes it by the hilt, then grips the sheath and pulls the blade free. The knife, ornate, golden, bejeweled, looks exactly like the knife in the painting behind the X, the one with the young man driving the blade into the old man's chest. Young O'Malley smiles wide, points the tip at his former self.
If it makes you feel better, old man, this is exactly how I thought it would turn out, which means it's exactly how you thought it would turn out, too. My, how interesting to talk to oneself.
The old monster pulls at the restraints, but he was weak even before this ordeal began.
Please, he says, I'm not ready. It's not fair. I want to live. Why did I spend 1,000 years in agony if I don't get to live?
So much pain in that voice, so much betrayal. I almost feel sorry for him. The overwrite, it doesn't move the consciousness of the old person. It copies it, leaving two versions. The old version remains trapped in its fragile, failing body. Young O'Malley flips the knife in the air, catches it by the hilt. He walks closer to the axe.
Don't be sad, old me. You got to live for 1,000 years.
I'll get to live for 1,000 more. From behind the fleshy folds, hiding its mouth, the old monster screams nonsensical words, babbles and begs, but it does no good. Young O'Malley places the point of the knife on his old self's chest, then leans in. The gnarled skin punctures. Red-gray blood leaks down. There is a moment of hesitation, then a crack as the knife punches through bone and sinks deep. The old monster twitches.
No,
it says in a faint hiss.
I was supposed to live forever.
The head droops. The old man moves no more. Young O'Malley, now the only O'Malley, pulls the knife free. He wipes the flat of the blade against his dead former self, scraping free the red-gray blood. He slips the knife back into the sheath, then slides the sheath into the belt of his black coveralls. The lump in my throat changes, becomes a fist. I turn my head to the side just before I vomit bits of spicy meat all over my coffin's white linen and onto the stone floor.
Kenzie, she vomited, Matilda says. Is her brain all right? Does she have a concussion?
Old Smith shuffles off the pedestal platform. Her gnarled fingers grip my face, turn my head left, then right.
Hard to tell, she says to Matilda. To me, she says, how is your head?
It hurts, I say, so bad. Matilda huffs.
Like she's going to tell the truth, Kenzie. Don't be gullible.
So your former self can lie, Smith says. Well, isn't that a surprise?
Get her ready. Matilda's voice rings with eagerness. I'm done waiting. We're going to do it now, concussion or not.
The deceased, rotten stink of Smith's fingers combines with the acrid smell of my vomit. My stomach threatens another round. There's no food left to throw up, but my body doesn't care.
Wait a little longer, Smith says. Matilda, you only get one chance at this, and Bishop did knock her unconscious.
Smith releases me. I can still smell her fingers. Matilda glares at Bishop.
Thank you so much for that, lover.
Lover? The old me and the old Bishop.
Lovers? You wanted her here, he says, and here she is.
It's the first time I've heard the huge old monster speak. The sound tears at my heart. It is his voice. The voice of the boy who kissed me at the waterfall. The voice of the boy who, when all was lost and I was sent off on my own to die, whispered to me that he would send help. It is his voice, matter of fact and to the point. But it is also not. It is breathier, shorter. It is tired.
Matilda huffs in disgust. Maybe you did it on purpose. Maybe you tried to hurt her so I couldn't transition.
Bishop says nothing. Matilda sighs.
Fine, we will wait.
The old creature looks down at me. The mask hides the fleshy folds that in turn hid her mouth. But I know she is smiling. I can tell by her one remaining red eye.
Soon, my pet. Soon, we will be one.
41. The nightmare gets worse. It envelops me, makes me want to give up, to shut down forever. My bishop lies in the coffin to my left, where O'Malley died. In the coffin past him, my Gaston, and in the fourth and final one, my Borjigin. Old Bishop, Coyotl, O'Malley, and a few other grown-ups I don't know dragged them in, unconscious, locked them down. They are all awake now, the sides of their coffins lowered. Borjigin sobs, seems unable to accept that Coyotl is doing this to him. My Gaston cursed at everyone until Matilda went to work on him with the rod. He's not cursing anymore. We are all about to be overwritten. We will be erased. Spingate is here as well. She's shackled to a heavy ring mounted in the wall. She's crying. She knows she can't do anything for anyone. None of us can. We are all helpless. The new O'Malley struts around the room, laughing and joking. Same body, different soul. He is an abomination. The hulking ancient form of old Bishop stands to my left, at the head of my bishop's coffin. Most of the other grown-ups seem shriveled, all used up, but not old Bishop. He has their gnarled skin, red eyes, mask, and metallic life support frame. But 1,000 years of life haven't made him any less lethal. My bishop stares up at him.
I'm going to kill you, he says to his progenitor.
Old Bishop nods.
I know you would try, but the restraints are far too strong. It is best if you make your peace with the gods.
The ancient monster reaches down, places a hand on my bishop's shoulder.
I am sorry it has to be this way.
My bishop sneers.
Maybe it's better that I die now than live and become you. You are no warrior. You are a coward.
Old Bishop stares for a moment, then hangs his masked head. My bishop senses his words have hit home. He tries to rise up, but of course he can't.
At least let me fight for my life, he says. Don't you want to know if you could beat me?
Old Bishop's red eyes swirl. He looks at my bishop's face, then above his head. I see a green jewel there, the same one Matilda pressed to release O'Malley. The massive grown-up gently reaches for it. I hold my breath. His wrinkled black finger rests lightly on the jewel.
Don't be stupid, lover, Matilda calls out.
She's on the pedestal platform with Smith.
Do you really want to prove what a big man you are by damaging the body you're about to inhabit? Leave him be. It's your turn to transfer.
Old Bishop's hand drops to his side.
I want to live, he says to my bishop. I am sorry.
He lumbers to the black axe.
Uriah, Kevin, prepare me.
Coyotl scurries over, as does O'Malley. It is devastating to see their young faces so eager to help, so excited about killing off another of my friends. My bishop sniffles once, then twice. No, not sniffling. He's smelling the air. I don't smell anything. Old Bishop removes his bracelet weapon. He hands it to O'Malley, who slides it onto his own arm. Coyotl shackles one of Old Bishop's wrists, O'Malley the other. They lock down his ankles. Old Bishop looks at each restraint as he tests it, giving it a short pull. His head suddenly snaps up, eyes darting about the room.
Release me, he says.
O'Malley throws back his head and laughs.
No cold feet now, Ramsay's old chap. I know you're afraid you'll be stabbed in the heart, because you will be.
But the you that does the stabbing will enjoy it, I promise.
Old Bishop pulls hard on his shackles. The metal rattles so loud that O'Malley takes a surprised step back.
Release me, now. I smell something.
And then I smell it too. Burned toast.
The Springers are here.
Coyotl's nose wrinkles. His eyes widen.
Oh, shit, he says.
A flash and a deafening roar from somewhere past my head. Coyotl spins in place, falls.
Borjigin cries out, as if he still doesn't understand that the coyote he knew was already gone. O'Malley dives away from the X, hits the ground and rolls into a crouch at the foot of my coffin. Old Bishop rattles the X even harder. "Kevin, come back," he screams. "Let me out of here." Another gun roars. My ears ring. The overpowering scent of wet charcoal fills the room, singes my nose. I still can't move. Spingate screams in fear. Gaston is cursing for someone to let him go. Borjigin is crying, the sound somehow heartbreaking, despite the insanity and death that surrounds me. Springer's screech, a grinding war cry that sets my teeth on edge. Another gun roars, then another. O'Malley pops up. He levels his arm on me, using the bars across my ankles to steady his bracelet, and fires off a blast of white light. I try to kick my feet to throw off his aim, but I can barely move my legs. He drops back down behind the coffin. He's using me for cover. If the Springers chance a shot at him, I look left, my bishop's arms trembling, every huge muscle popping out, his face scrunched in quiet effort. Past my feet, old Bishop is doing the same, pulling at the metal restraints that hold him to the X. Through the chaos, I hear a voice that is not human. "Him! Him!" Barca has come for me. "I'm here! Can't move!" The sharp shriek of metal breaking, metal dying. Two curved pieces sail through the air as my bishop's right hand flies up. Then a sound almost exactly like it, but this one comes from the black X. Old Bishop's left leg kicks free. Pieces of broken ankle restraint clatter across the floor. My bishop fights with the thicker bar around his waist. He slides his fingers under it, lifts, grunts, but he can't get leverage. I remember how Matilda let O'Malley out. "Bishop, the jewel above your head! Push it!" He reaches up, fingers frantically searching the fabric above him. Another Springer gunshot. Coyote is somewhere on the floor, screaming in agony. Old Bishop grunts and jerks, making the entire X-frame rattle. His right foot comes free. He plants his feet on the stone floor and twists his body, pulling hard on his right wrist. I see red-gray blood trickling down from where the shackle cuts into his withered flesh, just before that shackle gives way. My bishop finds the jewel button. His restraints pop open. His face sheened with sweat, he leaps off his coffin table and slaps the jewel above my head, releasing me. "Free the others," he says, then launches himself toward his progenitor. Old Bishop braces and heaves. The entire X-frame rips free from the stone floor. He bends at the waist and twists sharply. The heavy X slams into the oncoming younger boy, sending him tumbling. I slide off the table and squat down at the foot of my coffin. O'Malley is gone. I don't see him. The room is filling up with swirling musket smoke. As my bishop gets to his feet, his progenitor tears off the last. The two men rush at each other, slam together at full speed, punching and kicking. A Springer is at my side, pulling me away from the fight. Its skin is a lush purple, but it is not Barca. I don't recognize this one. Three yellow eyes plead with me to move. By the curved red wall, a grown-up I don't recognize blasts a Springer with white light. Even as that one cries out and is torn to pieces, two more Springers leap high and kick out, knocking the grown-up to the hard stone floor. I recognize one of them, Bafa. Ceiling lights flash off his hatchet as he brings it up and whips it down again and again, arcs of gray blood splashing across the floor and walls. Musket smoke swirls, stings my eyes, burns my throat. Three Springer guns roar almost at the same time. Bang, bang, bang! On the platform, two pedestals shatter, erupting in flames that wash over Dr. Smith. Her withered body ignites like a bonfire, flames shooting up to the curved ceiling. Matilda isn't on the platform. Where is she? The ceiling sparks. The fire catches. It spreads. The ceiling is not stone, but something else. This entire room is about to become a furnace. The battle rages around me. Grown-ups fighting for their lives. Springers taking revenge for generations of slaughter. I stumble to Gaston's coffin table. He's still trapped and coughing so violently he's splattering spit on his mouth and chin. I press the jewel above his head. He's off in an instant,
dashing to the wall where Spingate is chained. I free Borjigin. He rolls off his coffin table, hits the ground hard. He pushes himself up, starts toward the sound of Coyote's screams. I grab Borjigin, stop him, shout in his face. That's not Coyote! Your Coyote is dead! Help me with Spingate! Red-eyed Borjigin stares back at me for only a second. In that brief moment, I see despair in his soul. He wipes his eyes with his sleeve, hard enough to turn the skin instantly red. Then he nods. Stay low, I say, and push him toward Gaston and Spingate. The smoke was annoying before. Now it's dangerous. A thin cloud that roils across the ceiling in noxious curls. The Springer next to me coughs hard, wide cheeks puffing out. Gaston and Spingate are pulling hard on the ring that holds her shackles to the wall, but the ring is anchored in stone and does not budge. Borjigin and I join them. Even with all four of us, it makes no difference. The Springer pulls his hatchet from his belt. He uses the butt end of the blade like a hammer, attacking the stone around the ring.
Harder! Gaston screams at him. Hit that goddamn bastard!
The stone behind the ring splits. Gaston re-grips the ring, plants one foot against the wall, screams and leans away, using every muscle he has. The ring rips free. Spingate grabs it, holds it. Her wrists are still bound by the shackles attached to it, but now she can run. Gaston's eyes dart everywhere, looking for a way out. The pedestal platform is fully ablaze, tall flames angling off the ceiling. Sweat pours from my skin. Through the smoke, I see a Springer by the bin racks, waving madly at me. It's Barca. I push Gaston and Spingate toward him.
Go to that Springer, now! He will help you!
Gaston makes no heroic comment about how he'll stay and fight, because this fight doesn't matter to him. All he cares about is getting Spingate out, getting their baby out. Coughing hard, he wraps his arm around her waist, guides her toward the racks. I shove Borjigin after them. He's not a fighter. All he can do is get in the way. Smoke is everywhere. I can't see friend or foe. Where is Bishop? And where is Matilda? I'm going to kill her. I'm going to end this. I crouch down low. My new Springer friend crouches next to me, its eyes narrowed against the burning smoke. Blinking madly, it raises up slightly to look around and is engulfed by white light. Heat so intense I feel it cook my skin before my body reacts on its own, throwing me away from it. The Springer is ripped apart, a living being one second, splattering piles of sizzling meat the next. Blue blood splashes out, all over the floor, all over me. I sit there, unthinking, staring at my fingers. They are spotted with beads of blue, each drop reflecting the raging fire above like 1,000 tiny jewels, all dancing in perfect time. That could have been me. What do I do? What do I do? Hands grab me, yank me to my knees. It's Borjigin, coughing so hard that spit flies from his open mouth. He drags me away from the mess and the sickening smell of scorched Springer.
Come on, he grunts. I'm not leaving you here.
I'm almost to my feet when he cries out, falls down next to me, holding the back of his head. I turn to face the danger. A fist drives into my nose. I stumble back, slump to the floor.
You two aren't going anywhere.
It's O'Malley. I'm dizzy, can't focus. I taste blood on my lips. I roll to my hands and knees, try to keep from falling to my side as the world spins. O'Malley stands in front of me, aiming his bracelet point somewhere into the room. This close, I see him work it, see how he flicks his fingers straight out, flat as a board, and a split second later, the bracelet flashes with white light. I hear another Springer scream. O'Malley laughs. He's enjoying the slaughter. On my hands and knees, my eyes are at his waist level. There, in his belt, the ornate knife he used to murder his creator. The boy I love is dead. Now I must kill him a second time. I reach out, feel the knife handle against my palm an instant before my fingers curl tight around it. One pull, fast, firm, and the blade slides free from the sheath. O'Malley felt the tug. He looks down, sees the knife in my hand. He opens his mouth to say no. Maybe, but he doesn't have time to say even that. I stab. The knife point slides through his coveralls into his belly, angles up against his chest. The blade sinks deep, doesn't stop until the hilt thumps against his body. He makes a noise, half sigh, half cough. "You killed him," I say. I pull the blade out. Blood spills instantly, spraying on my hand, my sleeve. Red blood. "I loved him, and you erased him." I stab him a second time, again driving the blade up and in. O'Malley stares down with an expression of disbelief. Wide eyes, open mouth. He shakes his head, just a little, as if to say, "This can't be happening." His expression changes, melts into something else. The eyes look at me with warmth, with love. It's the real O'Malley, my O'Malley. And he smiles. "Thank you," he says. He collapses. I catch him as he falls, his back on my thighs, my arm under his head. He's shivering. His blood, it's everywhere. The knife is still sticking out of him. "Kevin, hold on. I'll get you out of here." He grabs my shoulders with what little strength he has. His fingers dig into my coveralls. "Too late," he says. He tries to take a breath, but a spasm cuts it short. A shudder courses over him, through him, and his face shifts from love to pure hate. The same eyes glare at me, but it is not the same person. From deep in his throat, he growls out words. "You always were a bitch, Savage." His neck relaxes, his head tilts to the side. Dead eyes stare out. He was still in there. Borjigin hauls me up, tries to drag me to the racks, to whatever way out is hidden in the shadows. I knock his hands away. I grab O'Malley's silver bracelet, slide it clear from his hand. "Him!" It's Barca, screaming to be heard over the roaring flames. "Him! Move!" I stand, crouching against the blistering heat that blazes down from a fire-engulfed ceiling. My lungs burn and rebel. I cough so hard I can't draw a breath. The only grown-ups I see lie motionless on the blood-splattered floor. None of them are Matilda or Gaston. Four Springers stand victorious, coughing, bloody, wounded, exhausted. At least three of their kind are dead, but they won. Through the smoke and flames, I see a final battle still underway. By the ruins of the axe, the old bishop straddles the young one, raining down blow after blow, smashing gnarled black fists into ravaged pink flesh. Any one of those punches would shatter me completely. I slide the bracelet onto my right wrist. I feel it squeeze down on my forearm. My lungs burn. My eyes water. The heat is cooking me alive, but I am not finished here. Old Bishop stands on wobbly legs. His hands are a mangled mix of torn flesh and blood. On the stone floor in front of him, my bishop struggles to move. The worm of rage writhes inside my chest. I stride toward them. Borjigin and Barca fall in at my sides. Old Bishop stares at me, mask cracked and askew, chest heaving, red eyes blazing with pride. "I won," he says. "I beat him." I point my right arm at him. "And you still lose." He looks down again, then to the pedestal platform, where the corpse of Smith is lost in the raging column of fire. He looks at the broken axe, then back at me, and I understand. Even if I didn't have him dead to rights, he has no way to overwrite his defeated younger self. The big, broad shoulders sag. The shine of victory leaves his eyes. He is old, sad, exhausted. "I am so tired," he says. "I hurt. All my life, I tried to do the right thing. I followed orders. But those orders, they were for the wrong things. I followed them anyway." He grabs his mask, tears it off, tosses it aside. He points down at my bishop, at what was supposed to be his new body. "Help him choose the right thing," the ancient man says. My scorched throat and sizzling lungs won't let me answer him, so I nod once. He puts his shoulders back and stands rigid. "I am Ramsay's bishop, and I am ready to finally rest." I flick my fingers forward. My arm tingles with deep pinpricks. Then the white light flashes out and tears the black monster to pieces. I am the wind. I am death. I stumble, have to grab a coffin table to stay upright.
Borjigin and Barca helped my bishop up. His face is a swollen, bloody ruin. I can't believe he's still alive. He coughs up globs of blood. The other springers swarm around us, push me stumbling through the thick smoke. I can't see anything, so I let them guide me. I have to focus just to stay on my feet. The sound of the flames recedes slightly. Then a door creaks shut, and the blaze's roar drops to a dull crackling. A torch flares to life. We are in a narrow hallway, carved out of the observatory's rock. The springers gently urge us on. Only now do I get a good look at Barca. Leg bleeding, a blood-spotted patch over his middle eye, the other two eyes half-lidded from pain and exhaustion, his every move a source of agony. He didn't run and hide. As badly as he was hurt, he found more of his kind and came to rescue me. I glance at the Springer faces and see one other that I recognize. Him, Lafa says. He isn't laughing anymore. How could he, after what we've been through? I gently check my nose. Even the lightest touch fills my face with pain. I think it's broken. Bishop gently pushes Barca and Borjigin away from him. I can stand on my own, he says. He leans a hand against the wall, takes a rattling breath, then starts walking. We all move down the hall. I try to understand what just happened, parse out the madness of the last few minutes. O'Malley is gone. He was still in there, and I killed him. I killed him. I didn't see Matilda's body or Gaston's. I'm positive they're both still alive. I tried to send Borjigin away, assuming he was weak, but he came back for me. Borjigin saved my life, true, but without Barca and his friends, we would all be dead. The Springer Prince is brave beyond words. Although he unleashed violence just now, he did so because he wants peace. Together, we can deliver on that promise. The corridor is long and straight, like the ones we walked on the Zolotl, but at least this one is flat. Matilda, Bishop says, his voice a croaking, broken thing. Is she dead? You're not safe until she is. She's alive, I say. I'm sure of it. Matilda won't stop until she gets me, and we have no idea what this city holds. She built it. Maybe there are places other than the observatory where she could wipe out my mind. I assume Matilda got away. So where would she go? No, that's the wrong way to think about it. Where would I go? If I was defeated, if my friends were killed, what would I do? Bello's ship, I say. Matilda is too old to run far. She'll try and use Bello's ship to get back to the Zolotl. I don't know what time it is. Are we sure Aramovsky is still going to attack? If he isn't, we can go after her. He is, Bishop says. Aramovsky sent some of the young Circle Stars out scouting on spiders. They had just come back when he ordered me here. They reported hundreds of springers near a clearing west of the city. He said he was going to attack at dawn. I quickly explain what Barca showed me about how the Springer King is luring Aramovsky in. Our people will be outnumbered 100-1, I say. Aramovsky is leading them into a trap. Borjigin shakes his head. I don't think so. He's still wiping at his eyes with his sleeve. The skin there is rubbed raw. Before he ordered me here, I'd prepared 4 more spiders, so he marched with 6 of them. Zubiri and the others were working on other machines, but I wasn't paying attention to them and don't know what they might have fixed. The thing is, I fixed the cannons, all of them. The bracelets are nothing compared to what the spiders have now. Aramovsky will slaughter springers by the thousands. I wince and glance at Barca, forgetting for an instant that he doesn't speak our language. He has no idea that the Springer King's trap is going to turn into a massacre. We reach the end of the tunnel. We push through the thick vines, find ourselves on the street. It's still dark. We still have a little time, at least. Coyote Spider stands there, motionless. Gaston and Spingate are beneath it. 5 musket-armed springers are on top of it. Their skin is reddish-purple, more red than purple, really, and they are significantly smaller than Barca, Lafa, and the others. So small their muskets look bigger than they are. These springers are still children, the equivalent, perhaps, of our 12-year-olds. Maybe Matilda came for Coyote's spider,
but saw these armed youngsters and chose to slip away rather than engage in a shootout. Borjigin walks to the spider. He puts a hand on one of the five legs, hangs his bloody head, and starts to cry. Far off on the horizon, I see the glow of morning. The sun isn't up quite yet, but we don't have long. If I try to stop the battle, Matilda will reach her ship. She might escape. I want her dead. I don't want to have to choose between those things. But that's what a leader does. Make choices. Barca and I have to get to the clearing, I say, before the sun rises. He and I can stop this. Bishop's swollen face shows doubt that I can accomplish that, but he doesn't argue. We're in the middle of the city, he says. The clearing is way past the wall. Even with the spider, you won't make it before sunrise. The moonlight shines down on his face, one eye swollen shut, cuts dripping blood, his lower lip puffed out and badly split. For the first time since we left the fire behind, Gaston speaks. If we take the spider, we're only 10 or 15 minutes from the landing pad. Then the shuttle could reach the clearing in less than 10 minutes, including the time I need to fire up the engines. The words hang in the air. My friends are watching me, waiting. Bishop, Borjigin, Gaston, Spingate, even Barca and Lafa. There was no vote this time, and I don't care. I know what must be done, and I will lead the way. If we do as Gaston suggests, then we can never go back to the Zolotl.
I swore I would die on Omeokan before returning to that ship of horrors. But believing you won't use an option and removing that option completely are two different things.
If something else goes wrong down here, if there is another kind of mold, if the Springers decide they want war no matter what, if there is a disaster, anything, the shuttle won't have enough fuel to let us run away. Another decision, and all mine to make. I make it.
42. A thin arc of sun breaches the horizon. Long rafts of clouds blaze crimson, underlit against the dark blue sky. Omeokan's twin moons are starting to fade, ready to sleep the day away until the nightfall comes again. We had to leave most of the Springers behind. There wasn't enough room for everyone. With me, Bishop, Spingate, Gaston, Borjigin, Barca, and Lafa, it's a tight fit, but we managed to hold on, even as Borjigin guides the spider up and over the landing pad's thick ring of vines. The shuttle awaits us. Farrar and a dozen young circle stars crouch near the ramp. Three of the young ones aim muskets at us. The others hold knives or various tools. Picks, shovels, axes, more. The spider's 5 hard feet clack, clack, clack against the landing pad's metal surface. The machine slows. I'm off and down before it even comes to a complete stop. The circle stars see the Springers, shuffle backward, agitated and afraid.
Hold your positions, Farrar barks to his charges.
The young circle stars hold their places, but they don't take their eyes off Barca and Lafa. Farrar can't look away from them either, not even when he talks to me.
Em, what's going on? Did you see Aramovsky?
Get everyone inside, I say as I start past him toward the ramp. We're taking the shuttle. He grabs my arm, spins me around.
Aramovsky is the leader now, he says. We're not going anywhere without his orders, and those things aren't coming aboard no matter what.
Bishop leaps over the spider's protective ridge, grunts in pain when he hits the ground. Fists curled, he limps toward us. I hold up a hand, telling him to stop. He does, just a step away. Bishop is ready to fight, but in his condition, it's a fight he won't win.
Aramovsky betrayed us, I say to Farrar and the Circle Stars. The grown-ups are on Omeokan, and he's working with them. Do you know why he didn't take you to the battle?
Farrar looks at me doubtfully.
We're here to protect the shuttle against the Springer attack.
You're here because there is a grown-up waiting to put you in a box, to invade your body and wipe you out forever, I say.
They don't want you getting hurt or killed in the battle. They've already murdered Coyote, Beckett, and O'Malley. You were all supposed to be next.
I see the conflict on Farrar's face, on the faces of the kids. They are afraid that I am right, but I am not the leader, and I broke their trust when I didn't tell them about the symbols.
I also came here with Springers, the creatures they've been told are evil demons who want them all dead. Gaston and Spingate climb down from the spider.
Hurry up, you boneheads, Gaston says as he heads up the ramp. We don't have time for this.
Spingate follows him, as does the still-sobbing Borjigin. Farrar watches them go by. He has no idea what to do. I reach out, take his hand, make him focus on me.
Farrar, I'm telling you the truth.
He shakes his head.
Even if you are, I have to follow orders. I have-
Bishop's huge fist crashes into Farrar's jaw. Farrar's hand slides from mine. He drops, unconscious. Bishop draws himself up to his full height, shouts commands at the shocked young circle stars.
All of you, get in the shuttle, right now, or I will throw you in it, and take Farrar to medical so Smith can look at him. Move!
The kids rush to Farrar, their previous instructions forgotten in the face of Bishop's commanding presence. It takes five of them to lift the unconscious man and carry him up the ramp. I shake my head at Bishop.
I was handling that.
Bishop shrugs. Enough talk. We don't have time for it. He limps into the shuttle, leaving me with Barca and Lafa. I gesture to the open door.
Move,
I say.
Peace.
Lafa's eyes scan the gleaming metal shuttle. Has he been told about these flying machines since he was little? Did his culture fill him with stories about the carnage that machines like this wreaked on his people? Asking him to go inside must be like asking him to walk into a monster's mouth. If Barca thinks the same thing, he doesn't show it. My brave new friend hops up the ramp. Lafa looks to the sky and taps his throat. For some reason, the gesture makes me think of a human, sighing heavily in exasperation. He follows his prince up the ramp. I run into the shuttle, gesture to Lafa and Barca to stay in the entryway. In the coffin room, I see dozens of kids. All the symbols are represented. Of the people my age, I see Okariki, Cabral, and Opkick. I don't see Bodin, Johnson, Ingolfson, or D'Souza. They are with Aramovsky's army, cannon fodder to be used against the Springers. I look for Zubiri. She's not here. And then I see Bello. My frustration and anger draw down to a single point. Her.
Your fault, I say. It's your fault O'Malley is dead.
Her eyes go wide, not with fear, but with annoyance.
The transfer didn't work on Kevin? That's too bad. But how in the hell is that my fault?
On Kevin. She thinks I'm talking about that wrinkled old monster. Bello thinks I'm Matilda. Rage engulfs me without warning, hot and tingling and all-powerful. She isn't really just Bello anymore. She is all the grown-ups. She is the reason we have suffered endlessly, the reason my friends are dead. I rush her, hurdling coffins and kids alike. Bello shakes her head, a confused, what are you doing? Then I am on her. I slam her into the red wall. The back of her head hits hard enough to make the metal thrum. She cries out in pain and surprise. I bend my right arm, whip my elbow at her face. O'Malley's silver bracelet slams into her mouth. She falls, spitting blood and teeth.
You used us, I say.
I viciously kick her ribs with the toe of my heavy black boot. She lets out a sound that is more hiccup than groan, rolls to her back. Her hands rise up, trying to surrender or ward off the attack. I don't know which, and I don't care.
You were supposed to protect us.
I drop my knee into her stomach as hard as I can. The wind shoots out of her all at once. Her eyes widen in shock and fear. The fear of not knowing if she will ever draw another breath.
You wanted to make us just like you.
I'm vaguely aware of kids screaming, of my fellow circles shouting at me to stop, yet none of them lay a hand on me. I straddle Bello, pinning her hips to the floor. I punch her in the eye, feel the skin of my knuckles split.
You were all monsters!
I rear back, hit her again. Her head bounces off the floor. I hit her a third time, smashing her nose. Blood covers her face. Her eyes are open, but they don't really see anything.
You couldn't just let us be, I say. It didn't have to be like this.
I aim the point of my bracelet right between her tear-filled eyes.
Crying doesn't fix anything, I say. You cry because you are weak.
She trembles. She's beaten. She's helpless. And I don't care.
All I have to do is straighten my fingers. Then she will be no more. The shuttle shudders. I hear and feel a rumble. The engines. Gaston has started them up. It's enough to distract me, to make me look at what I have done. A deep cut above Bello's eye pulses with red blood. Her nose lies at an angle, bone or maybe cartilage sticking out of a jagged rip that leaks blood down her cheek. Her upper lip is split, bleeding badly. Her front two teeth are gone, and the left incisor is broken in half, a splintered tip jutting from bloody gums. A strong hand, gentle on my shoulder.
That's enough, Bishop says.
Come to the pilot house. The kids are staring at me, wide-eyed, open-mouthed, as are Okereke, Cabral, Borjigin, and Opkick. A handful of Aromovsky's young circle stars stand there, their faces alive and drinking in the violence. They look at me with newfound respect. I have spoken a language they were programmed to understand. Bishop lifts me, sets me on my feet.
Put Bello in an empty storage room, he says. Lock her in. Don't hurt her further.
People rush to gather her up, just as the kids outside rush to gather up Farrar after Bishop knocked him out. At the coffin room entryway, Barca and Lafa stare at me. How much of Bello's beating did they see? The shuttle shudders again. The unseen engine screams so loud, I almost cover my ears. Then the noise drops down to a mere roar. I sprint to the pilot house, gesturing for the two springers to follow me. Inside, both Gaston and Spingate are bathed in color.
Pre-flight checks complete, Gaston says. Shuttle, give us handholds.
Spots on the black floor rise up, seem to flow right out of the solid surface. Gaston and Spingate each grab one. Barca and Lafa do the same.
The floor of the pilot house accommodates for sudden banks or thrust, but it's not a perfect system, Gaston says. That means hold on tight.
Shuttle, open internal comm.
Internal comm open, Captain.
When Gaston speaks again, I hear his words echo throughout the shuttle.
Everyone, get into a coffin and stay there. This ride will be short, but the landing might be bumpy.
He waves his hand. I hear something click. He looks at me. And when he talks, his voice is normal.
We're ready, he says. Is this still what you want?
Behind Gaston, one of the walls shows the rising sun. The blazing red orb has just lifted free of the horizon.
Take us to the clearing, I say, as fast as you can.
Gaston nods.
Shuttle, initiate flight plan.
We lift off. I feel us banking slightly this way and that, but as Gaston told us, the floor shifts instantly at each movement, tilting to counter the effects. Despite that, I grip the handhold far harder than I ever held the spear. We rise quickly. Images on the walls change, showing us the spreading grandeur of Omeokan. In seconds, we are up high, much higher than the observatory. We can see mountains off in the distance. Great rivers, vast plains, and the ever-present yellow jungle. Barca and Lafa look terrified, but they hold on tight and make no noise. They have suffered much. A broken leg, a ruined eye, burned and blistered skin. Some of their cuts that have crusted over. Others still leak blue blood.
5 minutes, Gaston says.
The sun is up. Has the battle already begun? I look at Bishop. Cuts and welts dot his swollen face. His knuckles drip blood to the pilot house floor. The beating his creator gave him. I don't know how any human being could keep going after that. Yet here he stands, at my side, and ready to go even further.
You look terrible, I say.
He smiles.
And you look like a warrior.
I keep one hand locked on the handhold, while the other feels my face. My broken nose. O'Malley hitting me so hard. His knife. The way it slid into him. The shock on his face. His horror at knowing he'd gotten what he'd sought for 1,000 years, and I had just taken that away from him.
You had to do it, Bishop says softly. But what you killed, that wasn't O'Malley.
He knows my thoughts. I want to believe he's right, but I can't. Kevin was still in there, at least some small part. If I had captured him rather than killing him, maybe I could have found a way to bring him back. Instead, I stabbed him to death. In my head, I know I did the only thing I could. There was too much going on. Blood and death and fire all around. There was no other option. In my heart, though, I will always know I could have found a better way. Bishop reaches out, touches my cheek. So gentle. It is almost enough to make me forget the horrors, forget the things I've done. And my progenitor, he says. Don't feel bad about killing him either, because doing so saved my life. I nod again, but I know that is a lie too. Bishop's creator was done fighting, maybe forever. I could see it in his strange red eyes. He'd won his battle, somehow proving to himself that the man he'd become after 1,000 years of experience and wisdom was superior to the raw talent and energy he was as